Please stand with me as we read the Word of God. This morning we're reading from the book of Revelation, chapter 20, verses 1, 2, and 3. And I saw an angel coming down from heaven, having the keys of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years, and threw him into the abyss, and shut it and sealed it over him, so that he should not deceive the nations any longer, until 1,000 years were complete. After these things, he must be released for a short time. You may be seated.
Well, I'm going to say something today that I don't normally say, and that's we're going to talk about Satan. The passage is making reference to him, and so today we're going to be talking about the role of Satan, who he is, as well as the purpose that he has. People have a lot of confusion about his existence and why even have a being such as this. Why would God even allow this to take place? And yet we can see the sovereign hand of God in all these things. There are a number of ways that we can go with this particular passage, and we are heading into a realm of 1,000 years, and thus oftentimes referred to as the millennium. And so we could easily go into that route, and we will talk about that as we go into the text a little bit further. But today, I think it's just appropriate for us to focus on this one that is bound and that is going to be bound for that 1,000 years, and why that is taking place within the passage. Throughout the book of Revelation, it's clear that the book is about revealing things. And so what we're going to see is a revealing of this one who is bound within this particular passage. But more than that, what it ultimately reveals is the true nature of man. Because the question that you want to ask yourself is, well, what would it be like if in fact there were no Satan? In fact, if Satan didn't exist, therefore there wasn't any temptation, there wasn't any persuasion, there wasn't any deception, there wasn't anything that would be intimidating. The things that oftentimes allure us into the sins that we're in, what would it be like if there wasn't any Satan? And so we're going to talk about that and why this passage is so important in our comprehension and understanding of our relationship with God, which is a very interesting thing, but we're going to see that come to terms. There are a couple of passages in the Old Testament that give probably some of the clearest definition of this angelic being, Satan, and the two that I would reference to would be Ezekiel chapter 28 and Isaiah chapter 14. So if you just take a moment with me and look with me in Ezekiel chapter 28, we're going to begin with a kind of description, an origination, if you would, of this angelic being and the glory in which he at one time shared within the heavens. Scripture tells us in verse 12, as it segues, it actually jumps from the realm of the king of Tyre, and then it goes into one such as the king of Tyre, who was wealthy and by virtue of his trade became wealthy, and then it then parallels Satan with him. We know that it's talking about Satan at this juncture because it not only refers to the seal of perfection, but then it refers to him as the anointed cherub, which i.e. is the angel, an angel of the Lord. The picture is, if you look with me in verse 12, is you had the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. The one thing that you see repeated over again is perfection. And I think one of the things that it reveals to us is perfection without love is only treachery. In other words, you get a being that is nothing but perfect. What is he going to do? Demand perfection from everybody around him. There is no sense of mercy. There is no sense of care. There is no sense of kindness. There is no sense of forgiveness. There is only perfection. and anything less than perfection, well, should be snuffed out. Therefore, as you think of, once again, the angelic beings, they are lawyers of such, of perfection, and he was the perfect of perfection, and really capsulized that in his persona. So as it begins to describe him, it says, you were in Eden, the garden of God. You see in verse 13, every precious stone. So you can just feel not only perfection, but perfection and beauty. If you could imagine, I mean, some people you look at, wow, that's like perfect. And God says, no, that's perfect. And he has somebody that's actually perfect in beauty. So for all of us who maybe thought at one time that we were perfect in beauty, I'm not real sure that it's something that is a tag that you want to wear. Because, probably next time somebody says, you know, I feel like I'm perfect in beauty, we go, so you're like Satan. So. No, you probably ought not to say that. So, and please don't quote me. Is that going to be on the? Take it off. So anyway, it says in verse 14, as he's described, you were anointed. You were the anointed cherub who covers. See verse 14, and I placed you there. You are on the holy mountain of God. The description is all telling us. This is perfection. And as you go on, it says in verse 16, of course, the parallel of the king of Tyre. But if you look in verse 16, by the abundance of your trade, you were internally filled with violence and you sinned. In other words, by your success, by your exaltation in the heavens, this is what caused you to... You take somebody... And you say you're greater than everybody else. Well, that's that whole thing of power corrupts, right? And one of the ways that it corrupts is it makes you condescending. This is one of the reasons why Jesus was so against the Pharisees, because they would always demonstrate themselves outwardly as perfect, and it was that sense of perfection or that sense of, you know, condescension upon other people that. That was just so horrific to Christ. And so you read in Matthew chapter 23, his indictment against the scribes and the Pharisees that put on these masks, and he says, you have no idea what perfect really is about. Because we know, according to Romans, that perfection really, the ultimate perfection is seen in love. But you take the equation of love out, and once again, why this is so important for us to talk about is as you go back into the seven churches of Asia Minor, the one church, the church at Ephesus, was very much on target about what was right and what was wrong, but that whole love thing was starting to wane. And so the concern, of course, is that you just become critical, you become accusative, you become hostile, and it breeds a sense of violence. You internally fill with violence because of your perfection. Think of how short people become and how critical they become when they think that they're so much greater than somebody else, and they become impatient with other people because why can't everybody be like me? And so it really breeds a kind of violence if you think about it. You know, as Scripture says, the wealthy man in Proverbs, the wealthy man answers roughly. And why is that true? See, because he perceives himself as superior, and it is that which produces a violence. And he says, "I cast you because of that. I cast you as profane. You have destroyed, O covering cherub. You were in the midst of the stones of fire. Your heart, verse 17, was lifted up." And he tells you why. Why was his heart lifted up? Because of his beauty. More specifically, if you go back to verse 12, because of the perfection of your beauty. So once again, it was a whole perfect thing. And here again, perfection without love is only treacherous. So you corrupted your wisdom by reason of your splendor. I cast you to the ground. I put you before kings. By the multitude of your iniquities, in the unrighteousness of your trade, you profaned your sanctuaries. Therefore, I brought fire in the midst of you, and it's consumed you. It's a very, very interesting passage. And if you look with me in Isaiah chapter 14, you see that sense of oppression being equated with, of course, Babylon at this particular juncture. But it goes into, once again, the one that's behind this oppression, and that's Satan himself. It says, in the ultimate destruction of Babylon, the cry is, take up this taunt against the king of Babylon. Of course, the passage then goes into the realm of, you know who the spirit of and the force was behind the king of Babylon. So he begins to describe. And he writes this in verse 4, how the oppressor has ceased. So you have the sense of one who is oppressing and his fury. See, you can hear that violence. You can hear that sense of anger. You can feel that sense of hostility. Where did it come from? And the answer is from the pursuit of perfection. It's a very interesting point that you need to understand. People think, well, Satan's just this wicked, wicked, wicked angel. And he is. But where did the wickedness come from? And it was a pursuit of perfection. It's very interesting. So you drop on down, and he talks about this fury, and then he says, verse 6, which was used to strike the peoples in fury, unceasing strokes. In other words, he didn't stop. The anger just has a way of growing, and hostility grows. And you subdued nations, it says at the end of verse 6, in anger, unrestrained. So you can see, he used verse 11, pomp and music and, you know, try to make things look good. But he says, hell is excited to see you. Sheol is excited to see you. You're coming in, aren't you? But what's interesting, this particular passage, though he said in verse 12, it reads, how you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to earth, you who have weakened the nations. You said in your heart, I will ascend to the heavens. I will raise my throne above the stars of God. I'll be greater than God. Of course, that's the arrogance of perfection. In the recess of the north, I will ascend to the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High, verse 14. Nevertheless, you'll be thrust down to Sheol, the recesses of the pit. And people will look at you and they'll go, is this the guy? I mean, the day is coming when the glory will be taken away from him. And people will go, is this the one that really made the world shake? Is this the one that caused man to tremble? I can't believe it. You know, I can't believe it. So those two passages, in many respects, give us a little bit of background into this great cherub in heavens and how he came to his fall and the inward thoughts of his mind and his heart. As we come into Revelation chapter 20, what is about to happen is taking the Satan equation out of the lives of people. Used to be a comedian a number of years ago, would always used to say, the devil made me do it. Mm-hmm. And I think that it kind of stuck with a lot of people because, hey, we got somebody to blame. And so the necessity of this happening in this time of the millennium is extremely poignant in the sense that Satan has to be taken out of the equation so people understand that it wasn't Satan that made you do it. What it was Satan that emboldened you to do what you wanted to do, but it wasn't Satan that made you do it. Now, the interesting thing about Satan is that we know by virtue of his name, Diabolos, the devil, that is oftentimes used. And if you look with me in verse 2, he actually goes through the various names of Satan. In fact, this same grouping of names is used in Revelation chapter 12, verse 9. So, you know, we know that he's called Satan, the devil, the serpent, the dragon. And he lists that within the passage. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. So he's actually given us description of who he is and what he has become. Every one of those names really describes the character and the nature of this being and how he operates. So, you know, in a very short, succinct verse, what God has done is He says, this is how he operates. This is what he does. Paul will write to the Corinthians, we're not ignorant about the way that Satan works, about the schemes of Satan. We know what he's doing, and we know how he works. We know how he operates. If you were to look at the passage and you were to look at the different names, he starts off by saying he laid hold of the dragon. Now, the word dragon, drakon, that is used within the passage is gives you a sense of this mystic, huge, ominous being that causes you to be drawn to in appearance. Thus, the root word actually means to look upon. I don't know if you knew that with a dragon. So the point is by virtue of his great power, his great strength, by virtue of the fact that he is just intimidating as well as mystifying, draws you to look upon him. And because of his sense of greatness, and it attracts us. There are certain things that attract us, not necessarily perhaps things of beauty, although he could clearly reveal himself in such manner, but there are just certain things that are so amazing, so powerful, so huge, that you just can't keep your eyes off of. And there is a sense of attraction. If you just do this interesting parallel that's in Revelation, dragon, lamb. Okay, so what's going to draw your attention? See, and that's the point. And if you think about it, this is how he operates in the world. Neon lights, fireworks, grand pageantry. Well, what's going to grab your attention? Or some people praying off at the corner. This is how he operates. And so you begin to understand there's a power in this, and this is why Babylon is so attractive to the people of God. It makes sense. That's what he does. So the passage not only makes reference to the fact that he's a dragon, but that he's a serpent. A serpent, in the Greek as well as in the Old Testament, actually makes reference to somebody that's cunning. If you go to the Old Testament, it has the connotation of whispering. You want to get somebody's attention, just start whispering something. But there's a sense of cunning, venomous, really cunning and deceptive, often undetected. You know, kind of, where did that come from? By the time it's there, you know, but that's how he works, right? He's deceptive. He's cunning in the things that he does, and the way that he attacks is just very, very destructive and venomous. So interesting description that is used there. Who is the devil, Diabolos, making reference to the fact that he's the accuser. Accuser of the brethren, of course, that's made mention of in Revelation chapter 12. He accuses the brethren, and we know night and day standing before God, this is the one that points out your faults. Now, Jesus, interestingly enough, because he is the serpent of old, calls him the liar, the father of lies. He's the father of lies. But what's interesting is that in his accusations against us, and, you know, I think there are a number of accusations that he throws against us. One is that oftentimes I think we're, you know, maybe he accuses us of being disingenuous, or he accuses us of being filthy, or he accuses us of being disloyal or flawed or fickle or fake or phony or whatever. There are things that he can accuse us of, and the thought is, well, how dare him accuse us? But he's true. It's right. We are. We are fickle. We are phony. We are flawed in our lives. In fact, all of our righteousness is with filthy rags. Zechariah chapter 3 is very clear. Here you have Joshua, the high priest, and Satan stands up to accuse him before God. And the text says his robes were filthy. So he has every right to accuse us. This is the interesting thing about his role. He can come before God, but when he comes before God, it has to be truthful accusations. And quite frankly, we give him plenty of ammunition. Yeah. I mean, Jeremiah 17:9 is, as we were talking about before the service, I mean, what a clear text that is. The heart of man is desperately sick. Who can know this? I mean, it's in me, Paul will say, I realized, well, not one good thing. So what is he doing? Well, he's accusing the brethren. Now, what he says that is a lie is, you can't fix this, or you can't be saved, or God doesn't love you. Now, he's going to lie about that. But all the accusations are true. It's sort of like when you consider the law. You know, I think one of the great benefits of the law is that it helps us come to terms with the reality of our life. I mean, if you look at Romans chapter 3 and you look at Romans chapter 7, two things are very clear in those particular passages. One is that the law causes me to close my mouth. That's literally what he says. He says you start reading, you think you're good, start reading the law. You start reading the law and you go, okay, I'm not that good. Read it a little bit longer, I'm not good at all. Read it a little bit longer, in me dwells no good thing. See? So what the law does is it not only closes every mouth, but Paul will say in Romans chapter 7, it makes me utterly sinful. And one of the reasons why people have a hard time, don't read me the Bible, you know, I don't want to hear that. Why? Because it's so true. So please don't give me that information. So what that law does is it reveals this. And look, the problem is that man is used to rationalizing his sin. In fact, man will not only rationalize his sin, he'll justify the things that he does and twist it around and calls it righteous, even though it might even be a sin. And if that doesn't work, what he does is he changes the definitions of words so that he can look like he's righteous in doing the things that he does. I mean, I was thinking this last week. I mean, man takes the word theory and he says, that's science. I mean, talk about how bizarre that is. How many years did we call it? The theory of evolution. We call it the theory of... Now it's science. Since when did a theory become science? It's how man is able to twist. He takes philosophy and he calls it knowledge. He takes wealth and he calls it success. He takes tolerance and he literally changes it into the realm of godliness. How could tolerance be godliness? When did that change happen? When did it happen that murder became choice? When did you change the definition of those particular words? When did you say that euthanasia is mercy? It's another name for mercy. When did that happen? So the fact of the matter is that man likes to change the names of the things to fit into his world, and that's why he doesn't like the law. It's so absolute. And you take a lawyer, and he can nail you on it every time. And so so this is what Satan does. I mean, Job was at best confused. Satan comes before God and he goes, Job thinks he's righteous. And if you were to interview Job at that particular moment, Job would go, yes, I am. You say, well, why did God allow Satan to do all those things to Job? Because Job was confused. Job perceived that his righteousness would get into the presence of God. Job finally comes to the presence of God and realizes his righteousness was not a leg to stand on. It was the grace of God in using. And all the way through, what we're going to see is that God is using this accuser to do things in our lives. We perceive this force as something that will attack us. And I would say, you have nothing to worry about. God is using all for good. And God is certainly sovereign over the affairs of Satan. He has to ask permission to go to Job. He has to ask permission to go to Peter. There's no problem here. He's not doing anything that God isn't controlling. That's very clear in the passage. As we come to this text, there is this great angel that comes down from heaven with these chains, and what is his goal? He's going to bind Satan for how long? For 1,000 years he's going to bind him. And once again, you at this juncture, you're not going to have the temptation, the persuasion, the deception. You're not going to have any of those things that are being influenced you during this time. The question is, well, then everything's going to be fine. Everybody's going to be perfect. That's not true. And this is the problem oftentimes in the lives of people within the church. They're saying, well, our whole battle is against Satan. Your battle's not against Satan. That's not it. The sin in your life is the battle. The longings of your heart, he takes those longings and he runs with them. As you go into the passages, we'll see this as it goes on. But it says in verse 2, and they laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, the devil, Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. So once again, you have this interesting picture of him no longer being an influence in the people's lives, no longer taking advantage of the weakness of people. Of course, Peter describes him as this lion that goes around roaring and looking for the weakness of those that are around. And the bottom line is, what is that weakness? What's the things that you love? If you look with me in James chapter 1, James chapter 1 is going to clarify why we sin. And what's interesting to me is that there's not one word in James 1 really about Satan, which is pretty interesting. Of course, we know that Satan's not omnipresent, so, you know, I don't know how he could be tempting everybody's life. I don't know how you could be that important. If you look in Revelation, he's binding him so he wouldn't deceive the nations. So you can see his power over the wielding of the leaders and the control. But if you look with me in particular in James chapter 1, it says in verse 12, blessed is the man who perseveres under trial. For once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. Now it seems as if the trial, the hardship, the pain, the suffering has something to do with the genuineness of your love. We'll just put it that way. Let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God, i.e. through Satan, however you want to put this. God did this. Wait a minute. God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when? When he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. So what was it really that enticed you? You know, I mean, I've nothing against eggplant, but if somebody were to walk up to me and say, ooh, eggplant, I go, ooh, eggplant. You know, there wouldn't be anything about the eggplant that would allure me. Now, you could sit there all day long. You could paint a face on the eggplant. You could embellish it with robes and clothes. It wouldn't do anything to allure me to eat the eggplant. Why? Because I don't like eggplant. The point of the matter is that you're enticed by the things that you love. Why is it that there was really, literally no temptation of Christ? There was a testing of Christ. Temptation is a bad word, I think. It was a testing of Christ. There was no temptation. He was only wanting to do his Father's will. He had bread that he loved more than the things of this world. When the disciples come to Jesus and they go, aren't you hungry? He goes, hungry? Do you see what I'm doing? This is food for me. Talking to this woman. Caring for these people. This is far more value. And if you do what you really love, do you really think about food in the middle of doing the thing that you love the most? Do you really? So what it does is what Satan does is he reveals our heart. It's a very necessary, he has a very necessary role in our lives. He reveals who we are, the us that is hidden. Let me show you a passage. If you look with me in Psalm chapter 66, just give you a few insights into this. Psalm chapter 66. and then we'll turn to another Psalms as well. But in Psalm chapter 66, this particular psalm starts off that we ought to shout joyfully unto the Lord, and he's great. There's no one more awesome than God. And this particular psalm is making reference to the great power of God. So when God is powerful, when God is great, when God is awesome, and he's demonstrating his power before men, how do ungodly men respond? Well, if you look, it says this. Say to God, verse 3, how awesome are thy works! Because of the greatness of thy power, thine enemies will what? Give feigned obedience to thee. What will they do? They'll subjugate themselves. See, one of the differences between a Christian and a non-believer is a non-believer will morph according to his surroundings. A Christian stays straight. If evil is in control, he still won't obey evil. He still won't bow down to the gods of Nebuchadnezzar. He still won't acquiesce to the things of this world. He remains steady. But an ungodly person, he has no scruples. He has no standards. He has no... Look, he'll fake it if he has to. It's about surviving. And so the point of the passage is, but if you're reminded... If you see in Psalm chapter 81, it says in Psalm chapter 81, verse 15, those who hate the Lord, what does it say? Would pretend obedience to him. Now, once again, what would make somebody pretend obedience? Well, here's the point. You take away the emboldening. You take away the influence. You take away... not only the intimidation, but the sense of encouragement for that which is evil and wickedness. And then on top of that, you make righteousness supreme and you give all power to godliness. Now, what do you think that the ungodly is going to do? They're going to submit. They have no choice. They have no choice. But the first clue that they have, the first door that you give them, they'll take it. And so what's interesting about the millennium, we'll go on and read this, not today. But as you come to the end of this, he says at the end of the millennium, he's released. So the passage is given reference to he's down, but he's not out. He's going to be released again. And that's what's being described within the passage. If you back up with me in chapter 20, it says they threw him into the abyss. They shut it. So interesting point. They shut it and sealed it, which means to conceal and silence, which makes reference to the fact that he has no more influence on the world anymore at this juncture, that he should not, if you look in the passage, deceive in any way, lead astray, cause people to wander away they're already wandering away in their heart, but he gives them the license to. He gives them, once again, we use the word emboldens. He empowers them to do that. And that they should not deceive the nation, he should not deceive the nations any longer until, see that interesting word there in verse 3? Until the 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. Why must he be released? To prove what's on the heart of men. Within the passage, the text is showing us the value, if I could put it this way, of Satan in people's lives. What is it? He reveals your heart. He reveals your heart. I mean, he revealed the heart of Cain that it was full of hate. He reveals the heart of Eve that it was naive. He reveals the heart of Job that it's not only erroneous, but in Job's life, that sense of self-righteousness was so much a part of him that caused him to think erroneously. And he reveals that. Peter perceived himself to be so loyal, he would never, everybody else in the whole world, in the whole universe, would leave God, but not him. So, what is it, Luke chapter 22? Satan has requested permission. And I've granted him the permission. Because Peter you think you would be loyal, that you have the power within your own being to stay faithful. It's not true. And I'll tell you somebody who will prove it. I mean, there are loved ones that we have in our lives, and we love them dearly, like ourselves. They deceive themselves in many ways. As somebody that loves them dearly, would you expose their lie? I wouldn't. In fact, the heart of a believer really should be more to cover. Mm-hmm. But sometimes the lie has to be uncovered. Who's going to do it? The value of keeping people from lying, and you don't think that it was healing for Peter to realize, I don't have the power in me. Why do you think Peter would wait now for the Spirit of God? Because the Spirit of God will give him power. And it'll be that the Spirit of God that will embolden him to do the things that he really loved to do. But God revealed the weakness of Peter's heart. God revealed the longings of Judas's heart. In the sense that we know, according to the Gospel of John, that he was greedy. And finally, Satan enters into him. But it was that heart of greed that he embraced all along. And it was that destructive heart that really hung himself. But it was who Judas was. And Satan revealed this. Of course, up to that point, the disciples thought, he's one of us. But God releases Satan, and he goes, he's not one of you. Look how different he is. He's one of his. And he reveals that. The necessity of Satan within our lives, and I think this is what, to me, this whole chapter is about. You can talk about the millennium and how it works, but what's interesting is that this chapter 20 doesn't go into the details of the millennium. I could take you back into Ezekiel. I could take you back into Zechariah 14. I could take you back into those passages, and we might reference in some of those passages. But this text is very succinct. I mean, we go through 1,000 years in just a couple of verses. So there's obviously a reason why we do that within the book of Revelation. And his point seems to be getting to the end, and that is, but at the end, he's going to be released. And the natural inclination of us is, when we read something like this, is to go, okay, why is he released? Why would he do that? But if you look at the very end of this, and once again, I don't want to go through the whole chapter at this point, but literally nations will gather together to fight against God again after he's been reigning 1,000 years. You go, where did that come from? What do you think? Satan gave them that heart? That's who they were. There's a passage, a really obscure passage in the Old Testament. It's 1 Kings chapter 22. It's about Ahab. You're familiar with Ahab? Jezebel? You probably remember Jezebel more than you remember Ahab. That's his wife. But 1 Kings chapter 22, Ahab wants to conquer this nation. He wants to, win this battle, and so he talks to his son-in-law, and he goes, say, why don't you pull in your resources with me, and we'll go to battle at Ramoth-Gilead, and I'm sure with us two working together, we'll win. The point of the matter is that we need to, take this land. It's ours, and of course, Ahab was a pretty selfish guy anyway. The text then reads, and I'm not going to read through the whole passage, but the text reads that Jehoshaphat, his son-in-law, he sits him down and he goes, okay, so you're going to go? And Jehoshaphat goes, I'd like to hear from a prophet that it's going to be okay. So Ahab goes, okay, I got prophets. I got at least 400 of them. So he calls in 400 prophets, and he says, I can just see him, tell him. So the prophets go, yeah, everything's going to be okay. Yeah, you guys are going to win, no problem, hands down. Jehoshaphat goes, I'd like just one godly prophet. Do you have one of those? And so of course, Ahab goes, why? But if you go down to verse 15, he came to the king. The king said to him, he finally gets Micaiah, and he spoke, and he says, okay, tell us what you're going to tell us. And I can just see Ahab. Go ahead. So, so Micaiah knows that Ahab is wanting to hear something. You know how you know. People already have their mind made up. So Micaiah goes, go ahead. You'll win. This kind of angers Ahab because he knows he's playing with him. And he goes, okay, you know I just want the truth, which is a lie, but that's what he says. So the king, the end of verse 15, go up and succeed. The Lord will give it to the hand of the king. The king said to him, how many times must I adjure you to speak to me nothing but the truth in the name of the Lord? So he goes, okay, you asked for it. So I see your people and they're all scattered and things are not going to go well. And then the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell you that he's not going to prophesy the right thing? That he's only going to get bad news? That's why I don't like this guy. I have these other 400 guys I like, but this guy I don't like. So Micaiah actually gives an interesting picture. Let me read it to you. Verse 19, it reads this way. Micaiah said, therefore, hear the word of the Lord. I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the host of heaven standing by him, and on his right and on his left. And the Lord said, who will entice Ahab to go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead? And one said this, while another said that. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, I will entice him. And the Lord said to him, how? And he said, I will go out and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all his prophets. Then he said, you are to entice him, and so prevail. Go and do so. Now, therefore, behold, the Lord has put a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all your prophets, and the Lord has proclaimed disaster. You say, why would God do that? Why would God allow that deceiving spirit to go? I can tell you why. Back up into 1 Kings 21. Ahab already doesn't like Elijah. And it says in verse 20, Ahab said to Elijah, have you found me, O my enemy? And he answered and said, I have found you because, look at the passage, you sold yourself to do evil in the sight of the Lord. Because of this, I will bring evil upon you. In other words, you've embraced evil. You love evil. This is what you desire, is evil. Tell him something good. Tell him something righteous. Tell him. He doesn't want to hear it. What does he want to hear? Deceiving spirit. Why do you think he has the 400 prophets that lie to him? He wants deceiving spirits. So the passage reads in verse 25, surely there is no one like Ahab who sold himself to do evil in the sight of the Lord because Jezebel, his wife, incited him. This guy's been incited by everybody all his life, but they only incited him to do the things that he loved to do. And it was a thing that literally defined who he was. There are things in our lives that, I mean, let's face it, we've deceived ourselves. We said we're okay, everything is fine. Let me tell you this about Satan. And I'm not trying to gather a bunch of people to have a thank you time for Satan in your life, but the point is that God is using him in our life. And God takes this one by the name of Satan, which literally his name means adversary or enemy. Have you ever felt an enemy attack you? Somebody that you knew just hated you and they were coming at you? Let me tell you what that did for me. I've had that happen a number of times. I wish I had, but a number of times. But you know, what that does is it makes me value true friendship. It does. It changes my heart. Up to that point, I think I was marginal at best in my longing for true friends. But you have somebody attack you, and then you have somebody come alongside you and says, I'm here to be your friend.
Amen.
And you go, whoa, wow, are you somebody I needed today? And that's exactly what Christ did. Christ came to these disciples at a time where they were being hit and bombarded, and the enemy was, and Jesus walks up to him and he goes, John 15, you're my friends. That's what he says. Now, in a world of adversaries, in a world of people that are your enemies, it makes you run to him. He is literally a serpent. He's cunning, he's deceiving, but you know people that are like that. But you know what that did to me? That made me run to people that were transparent, that were genuine, that were sincere. I mean, I began to long for that. You see, what he does is he reveals the true desires of your heart. If your desires are bad, then clearly you'll go into that realm. If your desires are good, the Lord will use him to cause you to embrace. Well, I mean, you have the devil who's the accuser, the slanderer. But you know, you've had people that accuse you, right? You've had people that slander you. You have people that have, you know what that does, don't you? Because you know how many times you've been unwilling to forgive. You know how accusatory you've been towards other people. But you have somebody hit you that hard, and there's something inside of you that clicks, and you go, you know what? I've not been forgiving. I need to be more forgiving. I need to be more compassionate. I need to be, wow, that really hurts. And the necessity of these things, I mean, you look at this great dragon and you go, wow. You're mesmerized by the glory of something so great and fantastic. And after a while, you realize there's no relationship there. And you begin to hunger for the simple and the real. I mean, everything about him pushes me the other way. And to me, it's the glory of this being that God has used him to reveal the hearts of men. And what you're going to see is 1,000 years, everybody acquiesces, everybody does. The wicked feign obedience. They fake it. They're okay with faking it. As long as there's a church, you know, as long as people are in church, they can fake it for a little while. Mm-hmm. You take them out of church, they do whatever they're going to do because they're in a realm that gives them license to do those things, that emboldens them to do those things. But it's one of the reasons why God has allowed the church to exist in this time, because we are, in a way, suppress that evil, and that evil, you know, kind of toes the mark as long as the influence of righteousness exists. But 2 Thessalonians 2 says the day's coming when that influence is going to be taken out. And then what's going to happen? Well, the lawless one will come in, and then everybody will show their true colors. It's good to know what the truth is. And God has value in everything that he does. Well, Father, we come before you today and we realize that the very things that you do, though we cannot fully comprehend, we do know this, that you're a God of love, mm-hmm. and you're righteous, and that you're doing what is right. There are things that are necessary in our lives to reveal the truth of our hearts, the very things that we suppressed, because really, Father, you've revealed to us through your word that the greatest treachery is not the rebelliousness outside, but it's the rebelliousness inside that acts like it wants to do the right thing. That's a greater treachery you reveal to us. And so it's your goodness to bring these things out in the open so that they can be dealt with, so that the deception of our own lives would be revealed. so that you would cause us to long for the right things as we begin to see the clarity of what evil is. With your heads bowed and your eyes closed, there are things that have happened in your life, hardship, difficulty, enemies, accusers, hostile forces. We've all asked the question, why would God allow this to exist? And God in his graciousness says, I'm revealing things to you. I'm revealing things to you. What is he revealing to you? You pray us, Sunday Place. Rise and sing this chorus with Sunday. Change my heart, O Lord.
Change my heart, O God. Make it ever true. Change my heart, O God. May I be like you. You are the potter, I am the clay. Mold me and make me, this is what I pray. Change my heart, O God. Make it ever true. Change my heart, O God. May I be like you.
Well, when I see evil in its clarity, well, I want to be like God, don't you?
Amen.
And it just changes my heart. I want to encourage you, tonight we have a time of fellowship and communion, as well as just sharing testimonies. And I think it's one of the greatest times when we can encourage each other that way. Lord bless you.